the order, and it's now 8th of February, and this is the first technical committee meeting of the Otago Regional Council for 2017. We have full membership of the committee with the exception of apology from Councillor Neil. In attendance, we have Dr. Palmer, and Dr. Mills. The agenda is confirmed. Are there any other late items to the agenda? No conflict of interest. No public forum. I move from the chair that the minutes from the 23rd of November 2016 are adopted.
And second then, Madam Chair.
Is there any discussion on the minutes? Okay. So we'll move on to the main part of the agenda then. And there are three items here for noting. And actually, there's the item numbers need to be numbered. Just 1, 2, and 3, there's just a typo there. I'm going to hand over to Dr. Palmer to just introduce the updated hazard map for the new district council, second generation district map. And as I understand, this is additional work that's just come, has just been finalised in time to get into the updated district plan.
Yes, Madam Chair, this is just an update on where we've got to with our collaborative work with Dunedin City Council on the 2GP process. Just summarising the nature of the changes that we've made to hazard information as a consequence of the submission process and pre-hearing discussions with submitters. We haven't attached the actual information itself because we expect that will change further. And once it's finalised after that 2GP process has concluded, we'll bring back to this committee for endorsement the finalised hazard information. So, as I said, it's really just an update on where we've got to with those changes. So, happy to take any questions, Madam Chair.
Any questions for the floor?
Yes. Yeah, no, thank you for this update. I've got two questions. The first one was reference on the third paragraph, page 9. Where the DCC has made some additions to the coastal inundation areas provided by the ORC. And so my first question is, who actually owns that information? Just how that process sort of works. We identify certain areas and then it gets modified. And then I'm just trying to... My second question is just where this whole hazard map sort of sits in terms of feedback from our community. Because I know that there was feedback from some of the areas that, you know, were potentially prone to, you know, the sea and issues and hazards, for example, Brighton and the designation of land. Just so my second question is just where does things sit in relation to communities and their perception of these hazard maps and whether they're useful or not?
Through you, Madam Chair, the answer to the first question is DCC had made some, through their own consultants, some changes to some of the coastal stuff, so they will own that information.
So they own it?
Yeah, that's theirs because they had some other processes happening involving that consultant, and so they've made some changes to some of the hazard information, so that's what's meant there, so that's they have to own that information, as they do. Your second question about community acceptance.
Yeah, acceptance is the word. Yeah.
The issues raised by the community around Brighton with some of the initial coastal information were resolved with some revisions to that pre-notification.
Yeah.
As a generalisation, the information has tended to shrink the areas that are identified as having hazard exposure, so they've not extended the areas. The flood stuff has been mostly tweaks around the edges. the landslide stuff has been refinement.
So are you saying
and there's been acceptance, greater acceptance of that. It's removed some of the uncertainties around things like what the buffers meant and those sorts of things. So the feedback I've had has been that there's been greater acceptance by the public of the new information.
Oh, that's interesting. So as we've provided, we've checked their detail, that there's, and listened to the community, that there's been greater acceptance, yeah?
Yes, it's been an interactive process, and that's also given staff the chance to explain it to them, so there's a better understanding of what it means as well.
Great. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thanks, Madam Chair. I refer to page 8 as well. The updated landslide, this is the third paragraph, updated landslide map for the developed area of Dunedin District included 1,083 individual landslides covering a total area of 52 square kilometres. That does seem extraordinary. Are these actual landslides that have happened historically and still have the potential to move, or are they pending landslides that may happen sometime in the future?
I think you should need to answer that one.
Yes, so that's the set of places where the land has already moved.
Right.
And then there's a subset of those which are known to be continually moving or are expected to move in the future. And that's a much smaller number of the 1,083.
Yeah.
The work hasn't looked into places where the next landslide will be that has not yet occurred. And that's what makes, as you know, landslides very difficult to deal with when it comes to planning provisions. But yes, 1,083 identified places where the land has moved across the district.
Yep. I still think it's extraordinary. Maybe I'm naive on such matters. Maybe weathering basalt is, and mudstone for that matter, more inclined to move than I thought it was. But thanks anyway, that's fascinating.
Page 11 it is, the point 6 discussion around the DCC holding pattern pending specific work on implications of climate change in South Dunedin, and then the next sentence about the technical report on natural hazards has been prepared to inform a review of planning considerations for South Dunedin. I wasn't too sure what that meant. Does it mean that there's now no reason to be in a holding pattern because we believe the information is now being presented, or what did that actually mean?
Yes, through you, Madam Chair, that's what it means.
Okay.
It was put on hold some time ago.
Yeah.
And subsequent to that, we've had the June flood. And then we've had our own work, which has now been published and shared with the community, on natural hazards in South Dunedin. And what is being said there is that there's no longer a reason to keep it in a holding pattern.
Yep. Thank you.
I'm interested that that there is a good acceptance from the community. Do you consider that's likely to continue as more information comes to light, and presumably this information will be available on the land information memorandum, or will it, or some of it, be available?
And
what becomes public knowledge in that respect?
Yes. So all of the information is public information anyway. All of it goes into our Otago Natural Hazards Database, and then the database is cited in land information memoranda that are issued by territorial authorities.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the connection that's made between this information and LIMS. But of course, that's ultimately a decision for the TAs to make as to how they promulgate that.
Any other questions? In which case, recommend that somebody move that this report be noted. Councillor Scott, Councillor Deeper. Thank you. Okay. Next report is on the air emissions inventory for select Otago towns.
Did I just need to move there, I think. What? Does it need to move it? I might put the motion.
That's a bit
fair.
Okay.
Need to do that.
I'll just move it.
We've got a second.
Yes, we've got Councillor Robertson there.
Yeah, we'll take to put that to the right now.
Those four?
Those four.
Okay, so carried. Right, the next report is the air emissions inventory for select Otago towns. I found this a good, indication of where are we now, what have we learnt, and also some of the background as to why those particular towns were chosen to be in the inventory. The information here is now going to be used to help direct further policy. It does look like we're making some gains in terms of our air emissions issues in Otago. Hope to see that continue. I'd like to hand over to Deborah, if you'd like to talk to your report.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon. So as you know, last calendar year we did commission an external air emissions inventory with a common basic unit of air quality analysis that all councils do. The last time we've done one was in 2005 at the start of the National Environmental Standards. So this provides a 10-year look at what's changed in these four selected Otago towns. Phone surveys were carried out at random, and we obtained just a vast array of figures on home heating types, fuel usage, along with some interesting demographic information. It's a fairly data-dense report, as you've seen, and the covering report just illustrates some of the highlights of that report and some of the uses, as you alluded to, the report will give us. At its core, it quantifies the amounts of various pollutants from stacks and tailpipes and chimneys. And of course, the metric we're most interested in is PM10 from domestic home heating. Since that is bulk of our issue. But we also get a really good idea of the profile of solid fuel burner stock in these four towns in terms of ages and types and therefore emission factors and emission amounts, which is something really usable as we go forward to develop strategy. Some of the highlights were that, no surprise, solid fuel burners are still used in the majority of houses in the main heating areas. Almost twice the national average of 37% of homes. So we're very heavy wood users. Table 2 shows that there are still a number of pre-2006 burners throughout the region. So there is a little room for change and improvement in some of those. Changeouts. In Figure 1, it shows us, not surprisingly, that the older, more inefficient burners contribute a larger percentage to the overall PM10 load. None of that's surprising, but it's really good to have it quantified so that we can use it in scenario development. As I said, it also provides a trend in what were emissions 10 years ago, and it was found that there's been about a 50% reduction in emissions in these towns, and that's through burner upgrades, less use of coal, phasing out of multi-fuel burners, industries changing over from coal to wood chip, use of bag filters, all those things combined have really reduced emissions, which is a good result. So just in summary, this is really good baseline data as we go forward and will provide some important inputs into the air strategy. We'll be looking at new emission reduction targets and then possible scenarios, taking into account, of course, the review of the NES.
Thank you. Also draw Councillor's attention to, on page 21, Appendix 1, the guiding principles as an approach to future air quality management, which I think is a very good sign of where we got to and where we might be going in the future. Thank you for that. Are there any questions on that report,
Councillor? Yeah, just, Madam Chair, through you, I just want to ask why only four towns? Yeah. Two expanding towns that do have problems, such as Clyde and Cromwell. I would have thought, with them expanding population base, that it should have been part of the research
yes.
survey.
In some part there was a budget constraint. I would have loved to do all eight towns, but we had to pick four. Every town is important. Obviously those are growing areas. Went through a prioritization process to sift out where we thought the first tier of study ought to be done. Alexandra is our priority site. Arrowtown, also another growing area with a big community involvement. Also been very intensive clean heat, clean air activity in both Alex and Arrowtown. We felt those were important. Central Otago site, and we wanted to do some coastal Otago as well. Milton, kind of a latecomer to the monitoring. We needed a little more information about Milton and its air quality issues, and Mossville, another growing area that hasn't received a lot of attention and we thought deserved to be included. So it's not to say that others aren't important, but we just went through a filter process.
So is that something that can be revisited, the number of sites, given the budgetary constraints? I mean, Monica's another place where most of June people are covered in smog.
I understand, and I guess that's something as we go through the annual plan process that would be something to be discussed.
Okay, I think Councillor Kempton and then Councillor Laws.
Thank you. Just one question I had scratched my head over a little bit is that the total production of BM10 site particles has halved over that time, but that doesn't readily reconcile with the frequency of exceedances. And so what I was wondering was if in fact the peaks, that is the peak rate of production, if you like, is still, so that is when it's really cold and the fires are stoked up, they're still producing as much as they used to and therefore the exceedance takes place, but that over the rest of the cycle they're a lot lower, or is there another explanation?
An excellent question. As you recall, we discussed at one point that originally the thought was always that a reduction in emissions, say of 50%, would lead to a reduction in the concentration of 50%. That was always the original presumption that was made. And we have found in Otago that's not the case. Concentrations have not decreased by 50%. There are many metrics to use to evaluate what concentrations are. The highest, the second highest for compliance. Top 10, top quartile, however you want to look at it, number of exceedances. I've always expected that number of exceedances will be the last thing to come down, but that the very high numbers would be the first thing to come down. And in fact, looking at reductions in concentrations, that's something now that is ongoing, using different metrics. We may have reduced concentrations in Alexandra and Arrowtown by about 30%. So there is reduction. You might not see it in the exceedance numbers, but we're seeing it in the top values.
If I could just ask a supplementary question. Will that relationship, will it have any impact with respect to the way in which you measure or with respect to new national standards that might come through? Because that must, presumably that is happening in other places too.
That's correct. Other councils, other towns have also found reduction in emissions doesn't equal reduction in concentration. So there is a lot of discussion and debate about this in the air community, in the science community, trying, if it's not a linear relationship, what is it? Is it a standard relationship that can be defined? Not sure yet. There's still work around that. In terms of national standards, I wish we knew by now. It would certainly help, but if I were a betting man, which I'm neither, I would expect to see a 2.5 standard over an annual average.
Yes.
Might be incorporated. And what that does to our measurements, well, that's another thing that needs to be studied and modeled.
Thank you.
Councillor Laws.
I'm a bit of a skeptic on this one, but I've been told that there's a paper, which I haven't seen yet, about the empirical relationship between emissions and health in Otago. Are you aware of that at all?
Yes. If you're referring to a 2004...
Oh, so it goes back that far?
Yeah, yes.
So there's nothing that's been done recently?
No.
Okay. And the second one is, on page 16, you'll note you've got the two bullet points there, which I think, I'm just trying to confirm, that's the policy currently of the Otago Regional Council in those two bullet points.
Your page 16.
Which is domestic heating appliances and what they're allowed to put out.
Oh.
Airplane rules.
That's the...
Yeah.
That's the current policy.
Yes.
Okay. Well, two things. First, these measurements are PM10. I think since about 2012 or 2013, most of the measurements in most district councils and territorial authorities have been about 2.5. Mm-hmm. Why aren't we measuring at 2.5? Which, as I understand, is the... Well, you know this, that's the...
Yes. Yes. To date, we haven't measured 2.5 because it hasn't been in the standard, in the national standard. And I know councils are moving to 2.5. And actually, we have a proposal for the annual plan to measure 2.5 next year. It is not all councils measure. Some do, some don't. But we are making a move to 2.5.
Right. And then when you go to bullet point 2, as of the 1st of September 2012, 4.5 years ago, any domestic heating appliance must emit no more than 1.5 grams per kilogram and have no less than 65% thermal efficiency. Tell me, I have a log burner in Cromwell, how would I know that?
You would know that because you've bought a compliance burner, following the rules. You use it properly. You haven't altered it.
How do you know that? I mean, I didn't buy a compliant burner. It's not compliant. I've got no idea what I'm putting out, and I've got no way of measuring whether I'm putting out 1.5 grams per kilogram.
And chances are it's not 1.5 grams per kilogram.
Yeah.
But that's the design standard, and that's what burners that are sold now and required in Cromwell, if you're in the air zone, are required to be 1.5, 4.7.
But you don't enforce,
that's
do you? Because nobody's knocked on my door. So you don't enforce, do you?
Oh, yeah.
Not you personally, but the Otago Regional Council. There's no mechanism to come around to make sure that is...
Yeah.
No, you won't come around. Listen, you're just going to find Cromwell first. But the second thing is, you asked that. The second thing is, how would somebody know that they are meeting or not meeting Otago Regional Council air policy? Brian, help me.
First, there's two points I'd like to make. The first one is, on the basis of a complaint, somebody could now come around to your house, so you've got a number of potential complainants. The second point is that...
I'm going to write to the local government commission about you.
Very good. The second point is that the MFE has a website. So what you do is you find out what type of log burner it is, and you refer to that website, and that'll tell you basically what the spec is in relation to efficiency and PM10. Yes, Dr. Palmer?
Yes, and under ideal operating conditions.
Under ideal operating conditions. So you're expected to put dry wood and so forth.
But I guess what I'm saying to you is...
So for example, in my place, I've got a lady kitchener. I know what the spec is for that and the fact it's complying and so forth. And I know I could put it into Cromwell to meet your spec.
But what I guess what I'm saying is, we've got a policy that we put together since 2012. And really, it's not being enforced or in any way tested. I know that because I live there, and everybody puts burn winter, and thank God, you know, want to stay warm, etc. But I guess what I'm trying to point out to you is in Alex and Cromwell and Clyde and those sorts of areas, really the last thing that anybody burning a log fire in winter cares about is what the Otago Regional Council policy is, even if they could find it. And this is the first time I've ever seen it, and I had to get elected to the Otago Regional Council to see it. So do we? What are we doing to, in actual fact, point out to the people who live in those areas that there's an issue?
Gretchen, I think, was...
Technical committee, and we're now discussing policy and compliance. For a while, we're going down a heavy compliance stance, and we had a timetable actually outlined very, very stringently with how we were going to go down that pathway. We got a lot of feedback from communities, fair enough, saying actually health potentially is equally impacted by being very cold. And we decided, well, there's going to be some changes potentially as well nationally to rules. We're going to not stringently enforce, so we deliberately decided not to do that. So you're right, council laws, and we're very limited with what we can do. We can't really go into a house, have a look at the specs on the fire and tell people to take them out. All we can look at is monitoring what's coming out as an effect out the top of the chimney. District councils can go in and look at how we're installing fires and what they look like. There's a gap in the regulations there. But if you're smoking out your neighbour and it's visually having a major impact, then yeah, we can give you an instant notice.
Yep.
Okay, Councillor Scott, you want to...
Yeah, I think if it's a regulatory discussion, it would be beneficial. Maybe Mr McLean might do a comment. I know that Jeff Donaldson... previously different protocols in terms of what was required in Central Otago, but as Councillor Robinson says, it's a technical committee, and I would just like to pause just for a minute and to acknowledge the success that has actually occurred. We're all running around here pointing the blooming finger. Look, in terms of air quality, we know that there's more that we need to do. We've got an air quality plan based on these principles that are here. We've got PM2.5 we need to address. We know there's work to be done. We haven't complied with the national regulations, and that's always been a disappointment. But here today, let's just acknowledge that we have reduced PM10 by 50% in terms of volume. So let's just pause and acknowledge that, because I remember 10 years ago when we sat in a room, we drew a straight line and a curved line, and then we were disappointed, and everybody, we felt we'd failed completely. But in fact, today, through this report, there's an acknowledgement that we've reduced PM10 by 50%. Now, as Councillor Laws points out, that there is still, there's some upside here. We need to get our strategy together, and there's been some questions asked in terms of a regulatory arm. And yeah, I'm sure there's potential. But what I also took out of this technical report was that we could further reduce the remaining PM10 by 50%, for example, in Arrowtown, if we made all the burners complying. So there's open fires and there's non-compliant burners, and that we could further reduce the PM10 by another 50%. So my math says we've already got 50% of the volume of PM10, we can do another 50% of the 50%. So in total, we could, it seems to me,
we know the answer, how to get to a 75% reduction. And that's not a bad opening bid, it seems to me, in terms of success. And so my question is quite simply, is why don't we just get on with it? Make the remaining ones compliant and the regulatory protocols and so forth. And if we did that, do you think we would actually, Deborah, achieve the rules? Because, you know, it was like 3 or 4 years ago, we came out and modelled it and said, well, actually, even if we made all the burners complying, but are we having a fresh look at that? And also, you know, if we're reducing it by 50% and then potentially 75%, what are the health benefits of that that we've already achieved? So two questions, or three questions. Why don't we just get on with it? The third one, if we did, would that enable us to achieve the PM10 rules? And thirdly, what are the health benefits?
I'm going to direct that to the Chief Executive.
I'll look, if anybody's got the answer, they can answer it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've been approached by the Central Otago District Council Chief Executive on behalf of her Mayor that they want to have this discussion.
Yeah, good.
How can we work together? Now, that didn't happen previously. Doesn't matter why, but it's happened now.
Right.
So to affect what you're talking about, Councillor Scott, we need the territorial authorities involved.
Absolutely.
Because they've got the Building Act responsibility. Mm. So I'm delighted that we've had that approach from Lee, and we'll be obviously following it up. So the Chair and I will visit with them on a number of matters, and one, that's high on our list. So that's good news. So it doesn't directly answer your question, but it opens the door for us to get those compliant burners in, if that's the direction we go. However, you know, we have heard from previous councillors who have sat in this chamber about line charges, about the cost of electricity, about the effectiveness of alternatives. We've also had the discussion about how do we regulate dry firewood, and if it leaves the firewood merchant's yard dry, how do we make sure it stays dry when it gets to your place, and coal and so on. So, you know, there are some regulatory requirements that might need to change if we're going to make those effects.
I acknowledge that this is actually good progress, and it's really good to see.
Well, some
and
good
it's
progress,
a complex
yeah.
issue, so yeah. I think for some of us, we're still trying to gain the background knowledge as what's going on and you know where we're heading. So,
okay,
Chair, you've just made the point, and earlier the Chief Executive used the phrase "good news." I want to ask the Director what his communication plans are from this report, because I'm a great believer in affirming good behaviour and therefore getting more. There is stuff in here which should be, and you may already have got a plan with Mrs. Rowe, how to disseminate the key findings of this report, which show that things have got dramatically better in some respects.
Well, that's my understanding. That is actually in train. And Caroline, would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, so we've got a media release drafted on this report for sending out afterwards, and then we've also got the Clean Burn campaign that we ran last year teed up, ready to go late autumn.
Through you, Madam Chair, I just wanted to say that I'm pleased, Mr. Chief Executive, that has happened between CODC, as I've raised that over the last 3 years since I've been in this council. But just for Councillor Laws's point of view, that if you need consent to add something to your room or adjust your house, you will have to be compliant with your fire, as I found out. I had to go and buy a new fire. So they come in and they said you had to get another couple of smoke things, and I had to get a new fire. And the stats will improve because my son is getting alterations. Has had to get consent, so his 1960s house, he won't like it, but he'll have to buy a new fireplace.
All you're doing is changing a light bulb, weren't
you? So it does activate. That's good.
So...
Very quickly, good comments from Councillor Scott. Good report as per normal, Deborah. This inventory, I was looking forward to this because there's a whole lot of unknowns, because the succeeding days are going up and down depending on the winter. And you think you're making progress a couple of years, and then you have a cold version layer filled winter, and you think you're going backwards again. But actually, we've reduced the output. I'm really pleased that when you look at the statistics around the use of coal, it's dropped a lot more dramatically than I thought it might have been. It's just about to the margin, in my view, we could probably harden up and ban it. And even in Milton, which is 18 kilometres from the cheapest coal in the world, and the poorest quality. But and it goes past, you know, the side of our roads covered in coal falling off car trailers and heading back to Milton and Dunedin in the early winter. But anyway, so actually it's pleasing. I think we've made more progress than we thought. And so it does give you, you know, good information to base the next strategy on. Let's see what Minister Smith comes out with, hopefully this autumn, with a discussion document on the review of the NES. Equality, and I think we've got a pretty good platform to move forward. There's been a strong education campaign over a number of years, and at the start of the project, Lauren was heavily involved, a lot of subsidy work and encouraging house owners to convert to efficient burning. I think there's been a chunk of the community that have undertaken initiatives on off their own bat without subsidy, and to deliver us the 50% gain. So. This will inform our next discussion, which should be good.
Okay, thank you. And Councillor Scott,
did you? Well, just my question to Deborah was basically, so we've achieved 50%. If we got the other 25% in Arrowtown, you know, like, are we still thinking we're not going to meet the PM10 regulations, or are we learning anything new?
We're learning. Can I go back to you on that?
Yeah, of course you can. Don't.
That's the issue.
I mean,
that's the next logical place to focus analysis.
Yeah.
That's
absolutely.
So that work is going on.
Thank you.
Councillor Hogue? I was just going to ask through the chair, Deborah. When we've talked about it, and there's lots of things happening, as you say, what Graham's talked about, putting a new burner in. Do you think too that the attitudes of people are changing as well? I mean, you can be forced, can't you, carrot and stick, because you've got to get a new burner, so you've got to comply, right? Like you're saying, with your one. But do you also think, you know, probably in your heart, that there is a shift in how people perhaps are looking after what we've got here? What do you think?
Chair, that's very hard to answer about people's perceptions and behaviors, and are those things changing? But I can give you a preview that the policy section has, in kind of the corollary to the air emissions inventory, has done a home heating survey in the same town to get those opinions and attitudes, questions about how do you perceive air quality in your community, and is it better or worse, and all of that. And that information will be coming to you,
thank you.
In the near future as well.
It's great.
Thank you.
Happy to move the recommendation, Madam Chair. I'm happy to move the recommendation.
Thank you. Yes. So we in agreement that the report is noted?
Aye.
So the final report is the director's report. There's a number of items in this. One of them talks about the Lakeslow workshop, which we're going to, that is the experts workshop back in December, which we're going to have a workshop on tomorrow, and basically a progress report, which is coming from the convener. Of the workshop. So it's a chance for discussion tomorrow, but then there will be a full report on the recommendations that came out of that workshop, coming to the March technical committee. So, over to you,
Gavin,
if you want to talk to your report, please,
on
the various items there.
Madam Chair, I'll take it as read. I just note the regional climate and weather situation that we've given you a little bit of an update, and just noted that Lake Wakatipu continues to remain high, so we've been running models on the lake and then assessing the effects on the Clutha River system and what it means for our flood scheme and the lower Clutha, and liaising with the three districts and Contact Energy quite closely. So that's just a bit of an update, and then we've talked about low flows and precipitation. I'm happy to take any questions, Madam Chair, on the rest of the report.
Okay, any questions on that one? I'm just interested actually in the Lee Flood Protection Scheme and the relationships with the university. Would you say they're on a good convivial basis, or are there some issues there?
Madam Chair, no, I think we enjoy a very good relationship at a staff level with the University of Otago, and no, there are no issues there that are impediments at the minute to that stage. And of course we're represented through Councillor Deaker on the Tertiary Precinct Planning Group as well, so no, they're very understanding that we're having to do works on their campus at the same time as they're also having to do works, so no, that relationship is very, very good. And as I've noted there, we're just going through some issues with negotiation around just insurances, and I hope we can solve those and be in a position to make a decision about award for construction very shortly.
Geomorphic change detection, you want to talk a bit about that? How do we get involved in this? I know that that's my university where I did my PhD, in Queen Mary College, University of London, so it seems a long way away now. Some reason that Otago got involved in this specifically?
Yes, through Madam Chair, the Dart River is the subject of ongoing research program from Queen Mary involving NIWA as well. It's been a good place to study the behaviour of gravel bedded rivers and test different techniques over a number of years, and this latest development involves coming up with ways of managing the large data sets that you can get from LIDAR data and comparing data sets to look at genuine changes in river morphology as distinct from errors in measurement, and then just ways of handling those large data sets. So we're very fortunate that that's one of several rivers in New Zealand that's been chosen, or areas in New Zealand, and we're thinking about the Shotover River as a place to do this further applied research, which will be of real practical benefit to us when it comes to managing the Shotover Delta and potentially other places. So it's really come about through a relationship with Professor Brasington over a number of years.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from the floor? Okay, can you move that the report be noted?
Yep.
That's the second. That's the Scott. Motion passed.
Aye.
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 Thank you. Okay, well, thank you very much, Gavin and staff, for those reports, and we do look forward to the workshop tomorrow for the Big Frank and Button March Committee. So I'll share the results at 4:16.
Thank you.